Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
And now,
it's time for
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast.
Welcome.
Hi there.
I'm Jesse Gaskell.
I'm Mike Sweeney, and welcome to Inside Conan,
an important Hollywood podcast.
Mm-hmm.
We are back in Los Angeles this week.
We're very happy to be back, but we had a great time in New York City last week.
We did. We were there for the upfronts.
Yes.
Which Jeff Ross, executive producer Jeff Ross
of our show, talked about.
He
at
did
length
in,
on an
in
earlier
monotone.
Episode. Yes, in his monotone way. And upfronts, again, it's when all the TV networks trot out their wares for advertisers and try to get them excited about the new season.
Yeah, new content.
The new slate of shows.
Mm-hmm. So what does TBS have in their new slate of shows?
Oh, I thought you were asking what was TBS, which a lot of listeners are probably like, what's television?
Yes.
What are these
shows?
Oh,
yeah. We should clarify, this whole podcast is about a,
that's right.
A TV show.
That's right.
Conan, hosted by Conan O'Brien.
On TBS. It's been on TBS since 2010.
It's in cable. It's in some people's packages.
That's right. Or a lot of people watch it online.
I watch mine on those little stickers that come on fruit.
I will only watch it live here in the studio. It's like going to a
You're
Broadway
a classic,
show for me.
Sweet.
I am. I'm very, very old school.
Speaking of Broadway, back to New York.
Oh, yes.
So you were at the upfronts.
Yeah.
Conan hosted the TBS upfronts, right?
He didn't host it. He just appeared.
He
went out and did
opening.
5 minutes. He got on early. He did great. And then he got off stage and headed out the door.
So you guys were there for about
20 minutes.
20 minutes. Okay.
No, about an hour total. Yeah. So, but it was great.
But I heard his set went well.
He did very well. Yes.
That's
for
good.
Our new overlords, because now our company's owned by AT&T.
Right. We
the
had
phone
the writers wrote a lot of jokes about AT&T.
They did. The writers wrote some great jokes.
There were a lot
jokes.
Of.
Conan did them.
Yes.
To
a lot
great
of,
acclaim.
After the upfronts, there's going to be a bad reception.
Exactly.
I had a line about there's only two bars at the reception.
The party only have two bars.
Yeah.
It killed. It did. It was
a room
great.
Full of executives. That's the worst thing you could have said to me.
And sales executives. And then we got out of there and then raced back to the hotel.
And then you and I met at the Earwolf Studio mm-hmm. in New York. It's very fancy.
Right by the it's right behind the library.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like giving the finger to books in the library.
Yeah.
This giant podcast studio. Where
we're
we
gonna put
out.
You out of business, public library.
Yep. And we talked to a lot of people who
used to
are
work
rarely
on the show.
In LA.
Yeah.
And so we went to them, which was great.
Yes, because they're that big mm-hmm. that we had to travel all the way
That's
to them.
That's right.
And one of those people, very funny guy that a lot of you probably know, is Chris Gethard.
Chris Gethard, who, hey, you're probably like, what's his connection with the Conan show? Well, he's been a guest the past few years several times. Great guest.
Yeah.
But we found out that years ago on Late Night with Conan O'Brien, he made several appearances
in
some comedy
It was his TV
sketches.
Debut. And
yes.
He was like in his early 20s.
He was like a kid in college who would commute into New York City from New Jersey.
That's right.
And because he started getting small. Well, there's a whole backstory to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're going to hear it.
You're going to hear all about it. I think Chris really wanted to talk to us because he had something he wanted to get off his chest.
Yeah, he had a really traumatic experience on the show.
Yes.
That early on in his career that it sounds like almost completely wrecked him.
Yeah, he said it was one of the most traumatic experiences he's ever had.
I'm surprised he stayed in show business.
I know. So he wants to come on and talk about it. So I don't remember what it is. I don't know what it is. And we're excited to hear what it is. And we promise when this is all over and we find out all about it, we'll play the audio of this momentous event in his life, this sketch that was.
Yeah, we actually played it for him.
Yes.
And in front of him.
Tried to cover his ears and close his eyes.
Let's get into it.
All right.
Here's Chris Gethard. Well, let's introduce our guest.
Oh, right. We have a guest.
We have a great guest.
Here in New York City.
He is a staple of the NY comedy scene.
Absolutely.
And a podcast aficionado. And he's been on Conan many times.
Many times.
Performer and then as a panel guest.
Yes. And today, hopefully, we're going to talk about some of his early performances on Conan.
Before there was even video.
Back when we were in New York. Yes. Before we moved to LA, which was now 10 years ago. So without any further ado, it's Chris Gethard.
Hello. Hi, Chris Gethard.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Well, you were already here because you were recording 10 other podcasts.
Right.
I was cranking out all sorts of stuff. Always making moves, hustling and grinding. That's what I'm known for.
You actually live here, and we had to knock you off your cot and say it's time.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was very excited to have a reason to leave my house. And I say this with love, but I had my first kid a month ago.
Oh my God.
Congratulations.
So, thanks. Anything that's like a legitimate reason to come up for air is a very welcome thing in my life. And I feel bad saying that because my wife has less of those.
Right.
Because we could have her on this podcast, too.
Yeah, she would love it.
We're open to that.
She's currently sort of like
handcuffed. I just assume she has a podcast.
Yeah, she has three or four.
Okay.
But yeah, she's currently serving the small god.
Wow.
Yes.
That has...
What kind of child did you have?
We had a boy.
Oh,
they call him a boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a god.
And he's the best, and I love him, but he has turned us into... I didn't realize they kind of enslave you.
Yes.
I didn't know that part. That's weird.
You thought he would just... go off on his own right away.
Well, everybody's like, you don't get sleep, but they don't mention like you're also at his beck and call.
Yes.
And every time he moves, you freak out. And then every time he doesn't move, you are
more
thrown into terror.
Yeah.
And every time he makes a sound, you have to like beg him, like, what do you want?
You
I don't know what you
it.
Want. And this has been going on for a month where he's like a weird god that has, he's enslaved us to his needs. And it's strange.
You'll do anything to keep him going. What's his name? You might as well tell
his
us.
His name's Caleb.
Oh, great.
I'm calling him Cal.
Cute.
I like that.
Yeah, I thought I really liked Cal. And then my wife and I both liked it. And then we reversed engineered. We Calvin's the obvious one, but I think I look too much like Calvin from Calvin and Hobbes. So if he looks like me.
Especially when you urinate.
Yes, especially when I'm standing on the bumper
on
of,
the
a
back
truck.
Of a truck.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to saddle him with that curse if he winds up looking like me and is named Calvin.
That is a thoughtful.
Bummer.
So did you two fight over names?
No. What we did. Fight over my wife always makes the joke she's fantastic at research, but she's not great at decisions, and I'm the opposite. I'm like, someone will be like, you should buy this thing, and I'll be like, great, sounds good, let's do it, let's go. My parents are the same way. My parents just bought a house that they never visited.
No,
they just bought it off the internet in Florida.
Like on eBay?
It was like through some real estate. It was in a complex that they really liked for seniors.
Oh.
So they knew they liked the complex and they saw a house come up and they were up in upstate New York because they're snowbirds. And they're like, yeah, we'll buy it.
I was going to ask where they did it from, upstate New York.
If they bought a house in Florida.
Have they seen it now?
No,
they're
going down in a week.
Had they been to the complex? You said they liked it.
They drove through the complex and they liked it.
All right.
Probably all of the houses are the same.
I think they were
complex.
Like, they're all similar enough
that,
and this one seems fine, but I take after them. So we didn't fight about names, but my wife had a list of about 30.
Okay.
And at some point I said, what if we each write our top three off the list of 30 that we think are okay? And she said, five, give me five. And then our both of our number one was Caleb. So that's the deal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What a great game. And then it reaffirms your love for each other and how you're a perfect match.
Look at that.
Otherwise, it's you would have had to divorce.
Look at that. Yes. It was
before
the
baby even comes.
It was really, because it was around like 7 months. So that prospect of divorce was terrifying.
Right.
I was so excited, though, to be asked because I have such I have such fond memories of, especially, I mean, of every, being on panel was such an honor, but those old days in New York, I look back now, it's one of those things where as you get older, you look back and realize, oh, there's been like a few stretches of my life that were these like golden ages.
Right.
And that being on the old late night show was a part of that for me.
That's cool.
Maybe
that's
the formative stretch of my entire life. And you don't know that when you're dealing with it.
I love that you have golden ages and you're still incredibly young.
I'm 38.
Yeah.
That's
but
young.
Yeah, it is. But I also started in New York when I was 19.
Oh,
so it is
50%
of my life.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So I think there is some like warranted reminiscing of like 50% of my fucking life.
Wow.
I've been doing this in this city. And there's been so many times where it's ebbed and flowed. And, when I started at UCB, it was really exciting because I was in college.
Did you start there like when it opened? I mean, were you?
Pretty close. Yeah. Right after they opened their first theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I think everybody from UCB, I assume I haven't performed there regularly in a number of years, but I feel like whenever you start, you feel like you just missed it when it was at its best.
Right.
So they had their first theater on 22nd Street, which was in an old abandoned strip club. I started right after they opened that. And then I always was like, oh, the people who were there, they used to do their shows at a space called Solo Arts.
Mm.
And I was like, oh, I missed the Solo Arts days.
Right.
I missed when it was at its best.
When it was just in someone's living room.
You got to imagine, I was 19. And I would take the train up from Rutgers University in New Jersey.
Oh, you went to Rutgers?
I went to Rutgers. So I was in, there was a little improv troupe there. And that was, you know, that was 20 years ago. I feel like now I have friends who their kid is taking improv classes and he's in fourth grade. And there's like improv classes in his town. Like there weren't many college improv troupes back then. So I showed up, you know, it hit the summer break. I was like, I really like improv. I was actually extremely depressed and it was kind of the only thing that made me happy. And I found UCB's website, and it was just nonsense. It made no sense. It gave no information. It was all bits.
Right.
I always remember their class description said, there were all these squares on their website, and it didn't say what the links were. So you had to click all these different squares till you found the classes. And then it said...
Was that intentional, or was that just bad programming?
It was intentional. They were real. It was real. It was very punk rock.
Yes.
In a way that... And I want to be clear. Like, I love UCB, and I still think they do a lot of great stuff for people. But back then, it was law. It was the Wild West. And their class description just said, we will teach you guerrilla fighting techniques and spit takes. And that was it. And I just signed up. I didn't know what it was. My improv group had been doing like the Whose Line Is It Anyway games. And then I'd come up and I was like, I didn't even know what long form was until I was like halfway through level one. I went and saw it. But being in college, that was, you know, I think that was 2000 that I started. Being a college kid in 2000, it meant you worshipped Conan. Like, I have so many memories being at this house that I used to party at. It was this punk house on Robinson Street in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we'd be blasting music and screaming and yelling. But when Conan came on, like, everybody sat down.
What?
I remember we would sit there with 40s and we would watch Conan. And we'd worship Conan. We all worshipped Conan. My brother introduced me to Conan, and then I show up at UCB, and you go on a Sunday night,
right?
And it's like all the people I was seeing on Conan
was ASCAP on Sunday.
You go to see ASCAP, and you'd see Stack and Dorf and Glazer,
Andy Richter.
You'd see
Brian
Richter
McCann.
Sometimes Brian McCann sometimes, and then I like took a class. My level two class was with Michael Delaney, who was on all the time. Then I was like, what? And then you'd see like the staring contest bits, and I was like, I'm like this close.
Right.
1 degree.
It feels like I am this close from just walking into my own television set.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got the call, it blew my mind.
How do you think, how did they find you initially?
Well, I can say very confidently, because I've been told this was the case, I was 20 years old, but I was a real late bloomer. So I was, in the early days, I was cast all the time as a teenager so that the production wouldn't have to actually
have
hire
like
a teenage actor and then bring a stage mom along
and
union rules
and all those rules.
So one of my first bits, I remember playing, it was a desk drive where I was dancing with a girl at a senior prom, mm-hmm. and he drove the car through the senior prom, and we all had to right. act like he ran us over with a car. Saying that out loud, it doesn't sound funny, but it was pretty good.
And, all behind his desk.
Yes.
Pretending the desk was a car.
Yes. And I was playing a lot of, when you needed a young, plucky kid, you'd call me. One of the bits I remember loving the most was Dorf wrote a bit about a kid going home for college on Thanksgiving break, and I was cast as that kid. And the good thing, Dorf always liked me. He would come around UCB a lot and taught workshops to us, and we all were scared of Dorf because he was the real deal.
Yes.
He was like old man Chicago improv. Oh, yeah.
We worked with him, and he was...
Well, all those improvisers, like,
you was look, tough.
They were all these like tall, like now improv kids are like me, like short, dorky white guys with glasses. But like those, his era, like you look at Stack and Dorf and McCann, they're all like 6 foot
imposing.
Plus.
Yeah.
Cary Grant started out in improv.
Yes. But I remember Dorf always liked me because I committed so hard, and he committed so hard. Mm-hmm. And he cast me in this bit where we came home for Thanksgiving break, and one of the beats was playing football with your uncle, and he played the uncle, and he was like, I'm going to tackle the shit out of you, and it's going to be real.
We were in
Rowie's backyard in New Jersey, or his aunt's backyard in New Jersey, and if you watch that clip, he trucks me into the ground.
Oh, wow.
I have so many fun memories, yeah.
That's great. That was a really funny bit.
I think he just wanted to bully you.
It was a trial by fire, for sure. I loved that one. I remember McBrayer got sick one day, and I got called in to replace him, and I was so scared because it was a Glazer bit, and I was terrified of Glazer. Terrified of Glazer.
Again, Glazer can be intimidating.
Yeah, yeah.
And
another improviser that mm-hmm. I worshipped as an improv nerd. And,
yeah. So what happened?
It was good. It was satellite channels. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that was, I was so scared because that was when McBrayer was like on a hot streak. McBrayer was like the go-to guy.
Yes.
And everybody always knew. Like the reputation with Glazer was like, you don't really fuck around too much. Like he wants to nail his shit. He wants to crush his bits. He's not the guy you go and like you're like rubbing elbows with in the van on the way to location. Like some of the writers, like this guy is, he loves comedy. He wants to nail comedy. And I could just feel it. He and I had never spoken. And I don't know. I don't want to put words in his mouth. I was also an anxiety riddled kid. But I remember feeling like he had McBrayer and now he's got me. And he's sitting here feeling like, is this shit going to get cut that I put all this work into?
Right.
And it was
Did you have to go to a tanning booth before?
I wish. And yeah, I had to have very white teeth and very tense skin. But it was...
You have the voice down.
Yeah. Me and Jack have... It's funny. He and I are so close, but we've also publicly torn each other to shreds so many times. It's a weird relationship. I played a Dutch boy on a show called The Weakest Clog, where I had to throw clogs against the wall, and then mine broke, and I had to be sad. And I remember Conan complimented my acting, was what I heard, and Glazer was thrilled. And I remember feeling like on the moon, like I was walking on sunshine because I made Conan and John Glazer happy, and that meant everything to me back then. That meant everything.
Oh my God.
That's so sweet.
I don't know. I'm not letting you guys talk enough. I should say that before the end of this, we should also at some point, because I can reminisce about all the happiest memories. Like I'm in the beginning. Was it the 10-year anniversary when you guys shut down the block?
Yes.
And he was like leading a charge of hundreds of us. I'm right up front. I pissed off Ben Schwartz, a young Ben Schwartz, so bad then because they put all the after actors up front.
Yeah.
And he said, he tells me to this day, I kind of big time. He wasn't an after yet. And he had pushed his way up to the front. And if I remember right, he was like trying to do bits with a friend of mine from UCB who's a young lady. And I think she had expressed that maybe she wanted him to stop. And I kind of was like, dude, you should back off. And he's like, you just tried to fucking big time me at the Conan thing because you were in the union and I wasn't.
Oh, wow.
When did he call you out on that?
A couple years later. Which
just
is not really my style.
It.
Yeah, he told me for years. To be
fair, it doesn't sound like that would be your style.
I hope his old partner never hears this. He had a like comedy partner back then who I think was notoriously kind of a... just annoying. He's a lovable dude who was just annoying. And my guess is I probably big-timed his partner, and he was the collateral damage. Because I really loved Ben from the start.
Yeah.
But I have all these happy memories. But also, I would say to this day, one of the scariest and most heartbreaking memories I have involved a Conan bit, too. Absolutely.
Well, we're out of time.
Yeah.
Yes.
You gotta tell
it
us.
It was bad. It was bad.
Oh, boy.
I still cringe when I think about it. I talked about it, I think, on a podcast or something.
And was this something that aired?
It was.
Okay, and
I can find it. Oh, my God. And people have found it, especially since the archive was just
You've talked about it.
I've talked about it publicly, and a few fans of mine were like, is this the thing you're talking about? And they will link to the clip, and I cannot watch it. And it must have been in 2002
okay.
or 2003. It was bad. It fills me with panic to this day. It was a bit... I wasn't even the funny part. I was the setup man. I was playing a page.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. The whole idea was I was going to run down the hallway, interrupt Conan while he set something up. And I just had to say, I forget if it was like the landlord is coming or Mr. Blah, blah, blah is coming. It was like some figure of authority in Conan's life.
It was like exposition.
It was the setup of like, hey, this guy that you're, he's tracked you down and he's on his way and I'm supposed to warn you, this guy is coming. And then I go away and the guy comes in and does the bit. And we rehearsed it and it went fine. And that's light lifting. And I had done probably 15 bits then. So I think I was like pretty accepted.
You're a pro.
People thought I was like a nice, quiet, hardworking kid. And I'd done a couple things that worked. So, it was a very family vibe. It was really cool. And even when you'd go and do bits that get cut and you're sitting in the hallway with all these people and it's just a fun day and like everybody's in a bear suit holding the head and then they're like, oh, a bit got cut. And you go, it was like the most fun stretch of life. So I was part of the gang and I'm not throwing anyone under the bus. It was my fault. But you will remember that there were, I don't know if they were of equal status, but there were two stage managers back in the day.
Yes.
And one of them, I think, was a little bit more of a taskmaster. And one of them, I won't name names because it's not fair. One of them, I think, was a little bit more, wanted to be one of the gang.
Yes.
If you know who I'm talking about.
Oh, one of them was
probably the one who still works for us.
One of them, yes.
Now.
And to call him a taskmaster.
I think when it's go time.
Oh, he was the taskmaster.
If it's who I'm thinking, it's the guy who I still run into in LA. It's just when it's time to get the work done, he's getting the work done. He's the nicest guy in the world.
But
when the show is up and running.
I thought he could have been either one of those people you described.
So the other guy, who I have a lot of love for, not throw him under the bus, he was the one holding the door. And the whole thing is the door opens, I walk out.
All right.
He has the headset on. And he's like, how you been? This and that. And we're talking and kind of joking around. And then all of a sudden he goes, oh, okay. And opens the door. And I was like, what? And I hesitate. So I run out and I'm like, Conan, whatever the name was, Conan, Mr. Hubert's coming. And Conan just looks at me and goes, in front of the whole live audience, I mean, this is the taping. It's not dress. He goes, why don't we take that back and let's see if you can hit your cue. And I was just like, okay. You just see
I'm
me.
I'm pretty sure that's not in the script.
You see, God. And I'm already such a pale person, but you just see you see the blood drain out of my face and I just nod and step back and the door opens again. I come out, I say the line again and he just gets a huge laugh. He says something like, oh, wow, that's such a surprise. Surprising news.
Idea.
Real surprising news. He really blindsided me with that one.
Right.
And roars.
Right.
And I went back out and it was just sweat. Hearing how I worshiped the show and then got to walk onto it. And then I'll never forget, though, the sweetest thing in the world. Brian Stack and Kevin Dorff, before I even got to the end of the hallway, I saw them run into my field of vision and they were like, it's okay. He got a laugh. He's never mad if he gets a laugh. He's never angry if it leads to a laugh. And I was just like, oh God, oh God, oh God, oh God. And I watched it that night.
You're inconsolable.
I think I cried when I watched it.
Oh my
God. I think I cried. And I don't know if it was directly related, but I stopped getting called as often after that.
Oh my
God. I stopped getting called as often.
Wow. Permanently? Or
no, I remember when the show was switching over, I got a call from Celia then.
Yeah.
It was like, hey,
Celia Plevo, our casting director.
Hugely important to me, like helped so many of us.
It was great.
In the early days, the UCB was like a sort of like a symbiotic
oh boy, yes.
You guys helped us all get health insurance through the union. It was huge. It was huge. And she called me when you guys were switching the show over and she was like, or moving to LA. And she was like, yeah, we're just, we're bringing in all like the old time people we love and getting everybody one more bit. And I was like, oh, great. So I was brought back, but I don't think between those two things I did more than one or two other things.
Oh,
and
boy.
I got why, because I mean,
Maybe you had just aged out of the teen look.
There's truth to that. There is truth that like some of those roles I used to get wouldn't make sense. Anyway, I was now like 24,
now
25 years old.
Yeah. Right.
Yes, yes. I was no longer helping to skirt child labor laws.
What you experienced, I observed, happened to other people because someone really wasn't paying attention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Same person?
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Or every now and then.
The queuing was not good. And I it would just drive me crazy.
But it was my fault. It was my fault. I'll never forget because he was like,
it wasn't your fault.
But the door opened and I knew it was just so, door opens, walk out the door. And he just opened it. I went, wait, huh? But, and I was like, oh.
But no,
it
is his job to cue you. And it's not your fault.
We will share responsibility.
Please let it go on this.
You can see, you can see my body language now, though. Years later.
Yeah.
Years later, you can see that I'm still like, oh, God, I dropped the ball.
I have a technical question.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be a very easy thing to pull up in post, right? The space after the door opened.
Gotta laugh.
Oh, I thought.
No, I mean, if Conan had just played it.
Wait,
you know,
correct me if I'm wrong. I got the impression. Did they leave in the whole
thing?
They
aired the whole thing on NBC.
I thought
they pulled it up because Conan.
Because he got
the big laugh.
He got the big laugh.
But if he hadn't, if he had just played along with it.
Right.
And not thrown you under the bus.
Right.
Deservedly.
Because
we knew then, too. All the UCB people knew. At Dress. Like, once they say Conan's on his way down, like, put your game face on. Like,
right.
He's the most lovable dude in the world. You watch him on TV. But, like, this is a job. And he's who he is for a reason. And you nail it in Dress. And then you help the... And the writer wants you to nail in Dress, so they get their shit on. And then you nail it on the show.
Maybe this will make you feel better. Conan cried that night afterwards and said, I should not have made
have
fun
so
of that
hard on him.
Actor.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, I should not have employed that human being. He betrayed my trust.
Now, you've been a guest. How many times on the show since then? As
three,
a panel guest.
I think three.
And have you
Did you ever
that
tell
up?
Him this?
No, I'm too heartbroken still.
You don't want to talk... Yeah.
Well,
oh my God.
It seems like the next time you're on, it'd be.
Yeah. We should redo
you
that
should show
sketch.
That clip.
If I am.
We should have you redeem yourself.
At this point, I felt really good about my first panel appearance.
Mm-hmm.
My second one, not so much. The third one, I felt like I bounced back. Conan's opinion matters more to me than it should. He does not. Know. I think I said to him on the air that when we were doing the Gethard show, I would constantly think about. Is this something that Conan would give a thumbs up to? That was like a standard. I took my writers, my entire cast and crew, actually, when we got picked up by cable off of public access, I rented a giant house in the Catskills, and we all went there for a weekend to just sort of say, like, hey, we're going to cable.
A retreat.
And I was like, I don't want to betray anybody who helped us get here, so we all got to learn how to do this.
Right.
And we're just going to go over. And I showed everybody the comedy that has most influenced me and influenced my approach to the show, and the very first thing we watched, and I've said this on record so many times, I was like, I think this is the height of comedy. As far as I'm concerned, this is the best piece of comedy I've ever watched, and it was Conan Takes Mr. T Apple Picking. To me, that is the high watermark of everything I was chasing with my TV show. If I could nail one thing as good as that, I would have felt good. So his opinion just matters so much. But now, the last time I did it, we actually joked around backstage a bunch. And I was like, okay, I can remember this is
I
just
I think
like,
he doesn't remember that.
And doesn't care what I did on a show in 2003. He didn't care that night.
He probably doesn't even know it
forever.
Was you.
No.
I don't
think he connected
I will
to
say
people.
That I legitimately do not think he remembers that I used to do bits on the show. I don't think he knows that. I'm psyched about that.
Right, because you're so professional.
Story.
Yes.
And because it means he doesn't remember that one day.
he does have a pretty good memory for when you make mistakes.
Oh, God.
But,
yes.
I mean,
why?
I don't mean you specifically, but just people in general.
No, anyone who works on the show.
Yeah.
And he brings up something I did that got cut in 1999,
That's
whenever.
Insane.
If there's just a quiet moment where, hey, let's enjoy the quiet moment. Or I can break Sweeney over the coals.
But you're also not the first. It happens all the time where people like it's their first big appearance on the show and they flub a line, which is so much worse than missing the cue, I think.
I always, and some people, you could tell they're a little nervous in rehearsal, and that's when that's usually, I'm just like, oh no, if they're... If they're not super cool in rehearsal, that's a bad sign. When you add the crowd and sure enough, they often go up on a line during the show. And it's just, it's the worst feeling.
Our head writer, Matt O'Brien, has his story of when he played Poseidon.
Right.
And was it Aquaman?
It was some made-up aqua god.
Yeah, and he stood up in the audience and... I think the line was, "And my powers are limitless," and he
flubbed
completely
it.
Tripped over. "My powers are limitless.
That's perfect. And then Conan's just like, "Except for the powers of speech."
Yeah, exactly.
And that made.
But then he got a huge laugh on it,
and did it make air?
Laugh. Yes,
it made the air,
and it was a blooper. We did the last week of the shows when we were winding up in New York back in 2009. That he aired that as part of a blooper. Bit, I'm but not also, your piece.
I am no. certain, though. That's the thing. I'm certain if I had the heart to watch it again, I'd watch it and be like, "Oh, it wasn't."
It's probably
it
not
sounds
that bad.
Really
it wasn't
fun.
That bad. I know.
Yeah, it's
Who
not
cares?
That bad.
But it cut me to my quick.
Oh God,
cut me to my core.
Well, especially the way he built it up, like you were working your way in. You're kind of like, you know, they're calling me once a week.
This is your dream job.
Yeah.
I wasn't one of the once a week guys. I wasn't Delaney or Charlie Sanders. I was a solid twice a month guy.
All right.
And then sometimes I'd go on a little hot streak. But here's the other thing that was so fun was I was part of this comedy group at Rutgers.
Right.
And then there was this other comedy group that was like much regarded as much cooler than
them.
And they hated me. They hated me.
Wait, this was at Rutgers?
At Rutgers. They hated me. That we had a little feud between our groups.
How did you get into a feud?
Well, I love it.
An improv feud.
Our improv, because we were college kids who took it too seriously.
Right, of course.
But our improv group was like, fine. And then we went on a hot streak where... there's a bunch of people who still 20 years later do a ton of stuff around New York who have, one of our guys went to, you know, Boom Chicago and has been in Katie Dippold, who's your former intern.
Yes.
Has written some hugely successful movies.
Like really big screenwriter.
Yeah. Like she and I were in the same improv group together.
She's great.
She lived on my floor freshman year and I convinced her, she was pledging a sorority. And I was like, what are you? I was like, you're 10 times cooler than that. You're so funny. Come join the comedy group. And, she was in.
Did she do it?
Did she listen to you?
Yeah.
She was in both comedy groups. And
Whoa.
If I'm going to, I feel like I can air out some dirty laundry. She was in that group first. And then I convinced her to join our group.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we became like the hot ticket around Rutgers. I'm not, it was college improv.
Yeah.
I will say.
It's
you
a
think,
big school.
But yeah, and you were appearing. Were you yet appearing on Conan at that point?
No.
Or? No, okay.
But I knew all those kids. So she was dating a guy in that group. I was madly in love with her. That was a thing where they were like, why are you in this group with this dude who's clearly just fawning over you? And then I knew all those kids were also watching Conan. I knew it. And then one night, the first time I was on, I was like, I know what's coming.
Yes.
And they went out of their way to just shit all over me. And I'm like, I know they're mad. And I know it's jealousy. And I know that in some way, this is
great.
Like... When you're a college kid in the year 2000, 2001, and you have a feud with another comedy group, and then I show up on Conan, it's like drop
Game
the mic,
over,
we won the feud.
Right. Were they like, what, are you related to him or something?
A lot of stuff like that.
Yeah.
A lot of
stuff. People love to go to something like that.
But it was also the best. I was like...
Oh, that's so satisfying.
I love
the dream.
You kept your trap shut and you just let them watch it.
Just let them watch.
Oh, yeah. I forgot to tell you.
I would go to every college reunion and still be lording that over 20 years
I have not
later.
Gone back to any reunions.
I
any reunions.
Jealous you went to Rutgers in New Brunswick. I went to Rutgers in Newark.
Oh, I never knew that.
Well, it's not something I brag
Same
about.
Same here. I hated it. Did you hate your Rutgers experience?
I commuted 70 miles a day.
From where?
From Montvale, New Jersey.
Montville?
Montvale.
Montvale, more up north.
Yes.
Yeah.
I was living
with
my crazy
Bergen County?
Mother. Yeah.
You know, I'm an obsessive Jersey guy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I worked at a magazine about Jersey for years.
I'm happy I grew up in New Jersey.
I love it.
I'm proud of it.
I'm probably going to move back.
I didn't turn my back on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Love it.
I didn't know you were obsessive about it.
I love it.
What's your big Jersey obsession?
Well, yeah, what was your beat at the magazine?
The magazine is called Weird New Jersey, and it's all about haunted places in New Jersey.
Oh, my God. So that sounds fun.
So this was the same era. My day job.
Pine Barrens.
Yes, stuff like that. The Jersey Devil.
Right.
Trying to think what's up near Montvale, because that's pretty far up north in Bergen County, right?
Exit 172.
You know, a lot of Jersey kids sneak into abandoned mental hospitals. There's the Devil's Tree, a haunted tree.
There's really
the Devil's
haunted.
Tower and Alpine. But when you're
nothing was built there till 1960.
It's crazy. Yeah,
so everyone's
true.
Still alive.
No one's died.
It's true.
Yeah.
No one's died yet. So
I loved it. I loved it. But yeah. Take the train in. I hated Rutgers. My life was like, I'd go to Rutgers. I think I packed all my classes into 2 days a week, maybe 3 days a week. I'd work 2 days a week at this magazine about ghosts, and then almost every night...
You did that in college.
Yeah, and then almost every night I'd drive in and do classes or shows at UCB.
You had a plan. I mean, that's very impressive to me.
Yeah,
I knew.
You were very cool.
I would be like, well, I'm in college.
I'll be honest. What I was very, very depressed, and it was the only thing that made me happy was comedy. And this magazine. So I was like, I know I'm going to drop out. And I tried to drop out, and my parents were heartbroken. So I was, they told me to get a degree. I got an American Studies degree. Mm. And I just
knew. How often do you use that degree?
I mean, I knew before I graduated, I was making fun of it. But I knew I was just like many Jersey dads, I was like, okay, I got to work as hard at comedy as my dad works at his job, or else.
Right.
He's going to call bullshit on this. So
were you like your parents? Did you choose Rutgers without seeing it first?
I did. I chose it without seeing it. And I largely why I went was they didn't make me fill out an essay on the app. My grades were good enough that I just sent it in as a safety school. And then I got in and I was like, I'll go there. And then I look back on that and realize, oh, I made a major life decision on a whim.
Yeah.
And I look back and I was like, oh, that was the beginning of some severe clinical. That was an early warning sign that I had what would later be diagnosed as pretty severe clinical issues with depression, but I just needed an
escape. Although it sounds kind of genetic as well.
Oh, yes.
Your parents are...
You mentioned your dad.
My dad's a workaholic. There's a lot of alcoholism in my extended family, not my parents.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah.
Rutgers, alcoholism.
New Jersey, hard life.
Yeah.
And yeah, it was just... I'd drive in, I'd get those Conan gigs every once in a while. I was doing shows.
It's so funny because
it's the best life.
It sounds like the opposite of a guy who's depressed. It sounds like a guy with a life plan. It's like, I'm going to go to college, but I'm also
really focused.
Yeah, very focused.
It was also just so exhausting.
Yeah.
I think that was where a lot of I was just like sort of manically trying to escape my own brain.
Right.
And I was so tired all the time. But I also look back and I'm like, oh, that was simultaneously one of the toughest stretches of life and one of the most beautiful, like you said, where I'm like, oh, I put in the work and made it work out.
Right.
I think that stretch of life is tough for everybody, too.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's a really, like, your brain is
growing.
And,
In
a way that is painful.
But you also, aren't you comparing yourself to other people you kind of look up to? And
constantly,
like, where were they at this age, at 22? And, oh, God, I'm behind.
Yeah, right. And then I was...
Always behind.
But you sound ahead of everybody.
And then some of the people at UCB would try to tell... Like, I was 21 years old. I was on a team with Rob Corddry, Jack McBrayer, Seth Morris, and Brian Husky. Mm-hmm. Like, these guys who were heavy hitters.
Yes.
And I was this kid, and I'd be all like, oh, God, I'm dropping the ball. Nothing's happening. And they were like, you're 21. And I'd be like, I know. And they'd try to explain. They're like, you're so ahead of the curve. Like, you've done this for years in college. Like, I remember Husky being like, we were all pissed when you showed up because you had done it in college. And we were like, that's not fair.
Isn't
you're
that
ahead
funny?
Of the curve.
That's funny.
But you didn't even get to enjoy your envy-making youth.
I didn't. Yeah. I look back, I regret. It's one of my only regrets was that I didn't realize that was such a good stretch of life.
Yeah.
And now I know it was.
Well, when you were doing improv with all these heavy hitters, like, did you ever get to a comfort level where you wouldn't even think about it and just go on stage? Or was it always like,
Eventually. Well, I'll say, when I got to that point where I couldn't think about it and never had anxiety, I got there, and then there were probably about 5 years where I still was, like, really heavily invested in, like, being the best. And then once that wound up wearing off and I was just showing up and doing shows and screwing around, that's when I knew it was time to leave. And that's when I kind of recommitted to comedy and attacked stand-up instead. Because I don't ever want to be someone who can just stroll on stage and not feel
that kind of worrisome, that worry, a little pit in your stomach.
And then you get the adrenaline rush that comes with defeating that. I just feel like if I'm, I didn't want to, no offense to my compatriots at UCB, but like maybe sometimes you'd see somebody where it's like, what, like, what are you still getting out of doing it? Like it's, and it's, I don't judge, but I just wonder. And it's like, I just, I wanted to keep pushing myself. So I switched to stand up after a certain point.
I love the, how you're always challenging yourself.
I try. I try.
So when did you switch?
Podcasting now, I know what's going to be the next frontier?
Well, I'm at a real crossroads because my show, you know, we did my show on public access for 4.5 years. And then we had, I think, 3 seasons between 2 cable networks. So we did over 200 episodes. Wow. It kind of defined my life.
Right.
And it's canceled now. And it was time to cancel it. And it hasn't made me too sad. And I don't have many regrets. But it's kind of the first time in probably 10 or 12 years that I don't really know what I'm going to do next.
That's kind of exciting.
It's kind of exciting because I'm now also at
an
age.
Might be a good thing.
I'm also now at an age and an experience level where I'm like, I think I have enough goodwill. I think people regard me as a pretty above board dude. That I think I'll land on my feet.
Right.
And it, in comedy, as you guys know, it takes a very, very long time to have that confidence.
Right.
But like, this is the first year where I, first year since 2002 where I think I'm not gonna make. Or no, it's 2006 where I'm not going to make health insurance through acting gigs. And I'm like, that's scary.
Right.
But I think I have enough money saved up now that I can just pay for health insurance and keep trying to maybe do some stuff I like. So I'm actually going back to public access TV.
Oh, awesome.
Which is maybe a downfall, but I'm going to go back in a way where I'm trying to build something to sort of take what I built. And I've always taken a lot of joy. If you look at the writer's rooms I had from my show, I think one of the big legacies of my show is there's a lot of people who are starting to catch buzz who their first gigs acting and writing were on my show.
That's great.
And I told being like a Conan. For
I was lucky enough to tell Conan that backstage. Yeah. I said to him, I was like, you know, you did that for UCB and I'm trying to do that for a lot of the young stand-ups in New York now. So like Julio Torres, who's at SNL and had a Times article written about him.
Yeah.
I gave him his second ever job.
Oh, that's great.
Joe Firestone went to Fallon and I gave her her first job. Gary Richardson, who writes at SNL, he wrote on my, like if you go through a lot of people's resumes who are starting to do the cool stuff and get sucked into the gears of the big machines, like
how did you find them?
I just love comedy in New York. Yeah. I just love it. Like there's nothing still to this day, you know, you do so many shows, stand up, improv, whatever it is. And so many of them are the same. And then once every 6 months or 2 or 3 times a year, you see somebody who you haven't seen before where you're like, oh, this city can still, you just still have to work hard enough in New York that brilliant people are gonna
pop up.
They're gonna show up with talent. Their skin is going to wind up thickened and you're going to see them and you're going to go, oh, and it really did. It gives me so much joy to be someone who can help them. So I'm trying to build a system where I can kind of go, public access took me to 2 different cable networks and we got a pilot on Comedy Central that didn't go. It's like we got, did that all. So maybe I can take what I built and recognize like, that's not me anymore. I'm not the underground guy anymore. I can't claim to be, but maybe I can build something that's, I put my name on and whatever that means to people, maybe they'll keep an eye on it. And I call, and I can go, these are the people who are slipping through the cracks right now, who are ready to blow up, who you're going to want to see. And that would give me a lot of joy at this age.
That's great.
Yeah. Make it less about me.
And it's a cool thing. Cause when you started out and you just want to be in comedy, the last thing you probably thought of is someday I'm going to get to help all these.
Yeah.
But it's, you must be very proud.
Very, very proud. Very proud. And I think of how the UCB helped me and I'm like, I'd love to build my own version of what they gave. Like they, when you think about it, they didn't need to build that theater and just hand the keys to all of us, you know? And I think about like Judd Apatow.
I mean, I think they've been paid for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it got them a lot. But when you, when you think about when it started, they were, they sunk all the money they made off their sketch show.
They didn't know it was gonna be what it is now.
Yeah, they doubled down and took a big bet on themselves and it benefited hundreds of us. Think about Judd Apatow has kind of taken me under his wing and the idea that I can, and then I think about those writers' rooms too that we built, and I've always wanted to ask you guys your perspective on this, because I remember, especially when I started coming around, that era, like, you think about all the guys who I was around back then in your writer's room, and I'm like, that's probably one of the best sketch groups that's ever been assembled. If you asked anybody back in that stretch who's like scouting Second City, mm-hmm. like who are the people you would want on S? I'm like, you'd want Dorf and Stack and Glazer. They'd be like everyone's top three out of Chicago at that time.
Yeah.
And Blitz and Coleman and
McCann.
You know, Allison and McCann. Like, you put all those people in the same room, and I was always so, I don't think I ever submitted to write for Conan. But I was always so jealous of, like, I want to be in a room with all those people. I want that. And then I was eventually able to build that. And it was a huge point of pride.
That's great. It was, yeah, back then, oh my gosh, we would do the show, eat dinner, and then go back and work on the next day's show.
Wow.
And it was 5 days a week. And the sketches like Clutch Cargos, things like that, were much more labor intensive to write. And also the live sketches would have several, it'd be like, oh, let's cheer up, you know, the postal service or something. It would have like pre-tapes, graphics, and then two or three little live sketches. And just assembling those every day was a lot more.
Yeah, people probably burn out a lot faster then.
Yeah.
It was so cool to watch though. It was so cool. You'd like do it in dress and sit there and wait to hear if Conan wanted to like move forward and seat himself. And then being in the room with all you guys when I was 21, 22, 23, and just sitting, you know, sit in the seats and wait for your thing to come up.
Right.
But just to watch you and him and the writer and whoever was there, and just to watch it just, we do it once, and then to just watch all you guys just pass the ball at lightning speed with like, all right, that's going, and this is getting bumped up, and this line needs to be a little bit better, and the ending needs something like this, and why aren't we? It was like a master class in comedy for
was
a 22-year-old improv kid.
There's a lot of the ending needs something like this. a lot of times we'd be like, oh, there's no ending. Endings are
pistol.
The hardest.
Someone that will, has to die.
That was so nerve-wracking, though, because for the live bits, we'd have to change a script, turn it around, distribute the scripts to everyone. Everyone checks out the new lines and rehearse it again.
Yeah.
And they were real sticklers. Conan and Jeff Ross about not going late.
I remember.
And it's like, oh, come on. How about 5:35? No, 5:30.
It's funny. It's almost like, I almost want to say it felt like comedy boot camp.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's almost more accurate to say that every single episode felt like comedy D-Day. Where it was like, it is go time, and let's go make it happen. Where it's like, we're flying in and we're doing it, and we get one chance, everybody.
Right, right,
it was just cool. It was just cool.
Well, the UCB, I mean, when I started there in 95, and then the UCB started in New York, and there were very few improv groups in New York then. It's crazy. I think there was Chicago City Limits.
Yeah, which was more of the short formy.
Right. And other than that, I don't think...
Yeah. Were there comedy sports? Was that
no comedy
that
sports? No. I remember hearing that a bunch of the UCB guys, Michael Delaney and Billy Merritt,
right?
They had a group that ran out of a theater called the National Improv Theater, which, if I remember right, wound up being a sort of front for Scientology.
Oh my God!
So there was like that improv group, and
those,
then a couple
those
independent
two often
things.
Run the same.
But UCB
track.
Noticed a vacuum.
Yeah,
and then.
Yeah. Yes.
Just all these talented people from around the city just got
just
sucked
right
into
in.
It.
And the original four, we used because they were pals with Andy and Stack and Brian McCann.
Mm-hmm.
They said, oh, let's get, you know, Amy and Matt and Ian and Matt. And they started, they were on the show two or three times a week in all these different sketches.
Yeah.
And I always kind of feel like that part of their story, just them being on Conan a lot, it never gets written about at all.
No, and it doesn't get written about in all like the UCB oral histories too.
Huh.
And it really should, because I think those, I think they fed each other in a real, I know that for us being like, because now you go to the UCB school, not talking bad, but like, it's a shiny place. Like,
right.
Yes. Big, and, and it's like every college age to, you know, 30-year-old person who wants to do comedy is, It's like mandatory now.
Isn't there a giant Bible?
They have a giant manual that Ian and Matt wrote, and it's like a college. It's like comedy college, and that's amazing. It's amazing and a victory for them that they built it. But you remember back then, it was like punk rock scum people doing comedy.
Well, where are those people now? They need a place.
Yeah. Public access television for the scum people.
That's where public access comes in. I don't know anything about the current state of public access television.
How do you do it?
It's wild.
Do you pay for it?
No.
You just get to do it?
I was doing my show at UCB, and it became a hot ticket, largely because in 2009... I randomly tweeted Diddy and was like, will you come do a comedy show in a supermarket basement with me? And inexplicably, he wrote back and was like, yeah, sure.
What?
So every time
I did it
once a month, and every month it would sell out instantly because nobody wanted to miss the month Diddy did it.
Yeah. Right.
So I had this like golden
thing.
Yes.
And then it was just me and a bunch of my friends, and we started doing, I thought it was just going to be a parody of a talk show because I've always loved talk shows.
Right.
And it just very quickly became this like weird, aggressive collection of people doing a lot of sort of like just fucked up bits, lots of like violent stuff and antagonistic stuff and very manipulative of each other. But people were addicted to watching it. And it was kind of running its course though. Diddy eventually came and did it. And then the show wasn't selling out automatically anymore, and then a couple of times it didn't sell out, and I was like, maybe I'll end this thing and just remember it when it was this instead of letting it peter out.
Mm-hmm.
And right around then, a former student of mine from an improv class sat me down, and he was like, you know, I work at the public access studio. And I was like, all right, I don't know.
What do you want?
Yeah. He's like, I think your show would be perfect for public access. And I was like, oh boy, here we go. But he was like, you know, it's a 3-camera studio. You can broadcast live. There's no content restrictions. He's like, you can curse all you want. You can have nudity. He's like, you can't be naked in the studio, but you can pre-tape it. All the nudity rules are just because they don't want like people's balls touching the chairs and stuff.
Sure. He's like, that's always a good rule.
He's like, you can broadcast it, tape it live, take phone calls. We stream everything online, so you don't have to watch it just in New York. And I was like,
wow.
When he described it, I was like,
a free studio?
And I was just like, I feel like he's just let me know about something that no one realizes exists.
Yeah.
And
I have free reign. And it took a lot of work. And in the show is, if you go back and watch they're all on YouTube, like it was really bad. It was a really bad thing. And our show had been so beloved at UCB that I was really cringing because I'm like, man, this version is just so shitty. And then, but when it got good, it got really good. And again, this collective of people came to sort of be a part of it. And very funny Conan connection I just remembered. So growing up in New Jersey, there was a guy who made his own homemade television show who I worshipped. Big influence on me.
Uncle Floyd. Who?
Is known legally as Floyd Vivino, the older brother.
What?
Of Jimmy and Jerry.
No way.
From the Conan Band.
Yes.
Yes.
I
remember sitting in the green room.
So they grew up in his shadow. That's...
That
tells me a lot.
He was, especially if you grew up in New Jersey,
the biggest deal.
Of course.
He was the best. He had this show so weird and
it started
so
out
funny.
On UHF.
Upper channels. And not he wasn't public access. He was like pay for play. His was like you can pay for airtime and then you're allowed to sell advertising, which you can't on public access. So he made a living off of it, or at least part of his living off of it.
And he did tours. He'd do like live gigs around.
Yeah, and he still does.
He
still plays like firehouses and like he had his own comedy club in lobby of a Holiday Inn on Route 46 in Wayne for a while called Floyd's, and I loved him. I think that explains a lot about me. You being familiar with Uncle Floyd and knowing the type of shit I've done.
Yes.
That is the natural extent. It's like a mix of Uncle Floyd. And did you ever listen to WFMU radio growing up in Jersey?
It's legendary.
It's like this weirdo station that my brother got me hooked on when I was 8 or 9. Just free form, commercial free, strange stuff. And then
I ended up reading about it. But
yeah, I grew up in West Orange.
Who's the famous DJ on there?
I think Tom Sharpling is the one that's like the comedy darling.
Right, Tom Sharpling.
He's a good friend of mine.
But Vin Scalza, wasn't he on there?
I think so, yeah.
I was thinking of the rock and roll DJ.
Yes.
He used to be in...
Real Tastemakers.
Yeah.
It's just this mix of like punk rock and WFMU and...
What was that crazy variety show on Manhattan Sure, you know about
Beyond Vaudeville.
Yes,
yes,
Beyond Vaudeville,
which became Oddville on MTV. That was one of the other shows that jumped.
Oh, right, it
skipped.
Then
Jake Fogelnest, who was around UCB in the early days, he did Squirt TV on Public Access, and that jumped.
Uncle Floyd jumped for a season.
He was
in
on
1980.
It jumped to NBC. SNL, right?
Exactly, and they took
like on SNL's off week, something like that.
And I was super excited to watch it, and they polished it up, and you know,
like
of course,
when Wayne's World gets bought by Noah's Arcade.
It was starting to happen to my show, by the way, too, on True TV, and that's part of why we were okay with going away. But you'll love this. So when I started on Public Access, I was like, I know who needs to be the first guest. Because if there's one guy who made his own, the Uncle Floyd show is so weird. He was like almost like an old vaudevillian.
Yes.
He'd wear like a hat and a suit jacket and he'd sing songs at the piano.
Upright piano that he'd bang away on with both hands.
Like, one of his big songs, I'm from New Jersey and I'm proud about it. I love the Garden State. And then he'd tell jokes and they were kind of like these lovable, cheesy one-liners. Right. A lot of bits with puppets on his show.
A lot of puppets. But and then
it doesn't sound punk rock to me, but I'm...
Well, here's the thing.
Tell me,
He had musical guests.
That, I was just going to say. And then he'd cut to the musical guest, and you'd be like, that's fucking Dee Dee Ramone.
Yeah.
That's Dee Dee Ramone. What is going on? And then this other thing I loved that I outright stole, and other people, I mean, Stern does it too. A lot of people do. And for someone who just complains so much about getting called out on a flub thing... Uncle, like you'd hear him, like he'd just like be rambling or something, and you hear the cameraman be like, "I want to go home, Floyd," and then he'd start like jawing back and forth, and he'd leave it all in, and you're like, "Oh, this is this weird show, sort of almost
sort of
like
a parody, but maybe
It's maybe like they all hate each other.
It's aware of what it is, though.
Yes.
So I went to his website, and I was like, if I could get the blessing from Uncle Floyd. That would be, what an amazing way to start.
That's a great idea.
He's the godfather.
I'm telling you, my show, which was really tiny and never really broke mainstream, we had good guests. I mean, we had Diddy, we had Paul Rudd, we had Method Man, we had John Hamm. Like, we had big people on my show. Lena
Dunham. The Ramones? I don't think so.
Never had a Ramone.
All right.
Never had a Ramone. The person who by far smacked us down the hardest, Uncle Floyd. Multiple times.
Really?
Angrily.
Oh.
What do you mean angrily?
Like just said no, like, he refused to be on it.
His manager emailed us. For a long time, I thought it wasn't a manager.
Right.
Now I think it was. But he basically wrote back and he was like, hey, Floyd never did, because I wrote and I was like, I'm doing my own public access show. I was really inspired by Floyd. He made his own show.
Right.
Explained the whole thing. And I was like, it would mean the world to me. I'm a Jersey guy. And got this email back that was heartbreaking where he's like, listen, Floyd never did a show for free. He was never public access. He always sold advertising. He respects himself too much as an artist. You shouldn't, you should, if you're an artist, you should. He goes, the honest truth is Floyd was a touring comedian. The gas crisis hit in the 70s.
Oh boy.
So it became economically not viable to travel as much. So he started the TV
Floyd
show.
Floyd definitely wrote this.
It was.
Only Floyd would have this information.
It was heartbreaking. It was heartbreaking.
He's got some serious blocks around it, it sounds like.
I wish I could talk with him because it sounded like a guy who didn't realize that very genuinely he inspired a lot of people.
Wow. It's weird because he's doing our podcast tomorrow.
Look at that. We even offered, so when we went to cable and we had budgets, I reached out again about let's book him as a musical guest because we can pay him for
that's great.
And he doesn't have to like be in the spotlight. He doesn't want. Just come on as a musical guest. Didn't want to do it.
No.
Wow.
And I did. I worked up the guts at one point when I was doing the late night show a lot, where, you know, you'd be in that central green room and everybody would be coming and going. And I think it was Jerry Vivino walked by and I finally had the guts where I was like, hey, I grew up in Jersey. And he was like, yeah. And I was like, I really, really liked your brother Floyd's show. And he just kind of was like, Floyd did some stuff, man. And we didn't
Floyd doesn't talk to me.
I don't know.
Not since the oil crisis.
But I wish I got to pick his brain more because Uncle Floyd is the best.
That'd be great if your next new direction involved Floyd.
I wish.
Yeah.
I wish I could get him. He's like my great white whale.
He is
your
great white whale.
Well, they say not to meet your heroes. So yes. It might be.
It's true.
Sounds like this what.
But to only exchange emails with their management team.
It was. But then I think. That guy has tweeted at me since and been like, congrats on everything. And I'm like,
So
you know it went well. Why aren't we getting Floyd?
Yeah.
I want Floyd.
Man.
I want more Floyd in my life.
I like, Yeah, maybe
it's he's not, you know, maybe he's not well or something. He could.
I don't know.
Or he got stage fright.
There's also rumors that he has the single biggest personal collection of music on vinyl in the entire world.
What?
What?
That's a rumor about Uncle Floyd Vivino. Because he grew up in a very musical family.
Yes, yeah. Clearly.
Apparently he's like spent his entire life collecting vinyl, starting with like old Italian opera that his Italian family would listen to.
Like 78s.
He has a storage space filled with tens of thousands of pieces of vinyl.
Oh my God.
He's a legendary figure. And
if he needs money, he could just sell some records.
I'm sure he could.
Yeah.
I would love... I wasn't so anxiety riddled as a kid and I had managed to charm the Vivino brothers into filling me in more because I had my shot and they didn't bite. They didn't bite.
Well, we see Jimmy at work.
Yeah, we could ask. We could ask.
Well, why don't we
let
ask him
know that? I'm obsessed with Uncle Floyd.
We'll get back to you.
Why don't we... This will be a little project.
Oh, yeah. We can have Jimmy on and we could ask him about it on the podcast.
Yeah. And we can, you know, if you have a pitch for Floyd, we'll work it through the family.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
But he was a piece... I think being a weird comedy kid on the East Coast, he was a... bigger part, like, I've talked with Apatow about him, where he's like, oh, yeah, we all watched Floyd on Long Island. It was like Floyd, Howard Stern, Andy Kaufman, David Letterman.
Yes.
Those, to me, were the big four of growing up on the East Coast. That's the mix that led
think of
to me
Andy Kaufman as an East Coast.
Long Island guy.
Yeah.
Long Island guy.
Yeah. When did you, did you ever go to comedy clubs when you were young or in college? You just went to improv?
I remember there's a... You'll appreciate it. Here's another thing I want to make sure I say, because I've talked to you about this. I got passed at the Comedy Cellar about 2 years ago. Do you know Mike Sweeney is still very legendary there?
I believe it.
I've told you that. Do you remember?
I think they're thinking of Steve Sweeney from Boston.
Oh,
people mistake me for him all the time.
Well, you used to host there all the time, right?
I did.
SD has told me that she still considers you, and comedians have said that you were the best host at the Comedy Cellar.
It's because I stopped doing it. So all of a sudden, it's like, oh, yeah, he was great.
But I always heard that you would go out there and just blaze with crowd work. And it was untouchable.
Well, I was very lazy. It's just, I was like, oh, I didn't write any, another day without writing anything. I'll make fun of the people from Denmark. That's my ticket to success.
Well, it was great.
I'm glad Esty liked it.
I remember there's a club that I bet you know in New Brunswick called the Stress Factory.
Yes. That's I work
like,
there.
It's like kind of a legendary tough room.
Yes, legendary.
And the owner, I think he just stopped doing it in the past couple of years, the owner himself would get up on stage and do this intro.
And it was
Vinnie Brandt.
Vinnie Brandt.
And when I was in college, I went on a date with a girl who I had a big crush on. She's a sweet girl, gymnast, very cool, very cute. And she was like, I'm going to organize our date because she knew I was pretty socially incapable. She had seen me doing improv. She's like,
but you're the decision maker.
Well, it's now.
Did she really say, I'm going to organize
our
date?
She did. She said, we're going to go on a date. I think we made out once, one night randomly, and then she was like, I'm going to organize a date.
Now we will make out.
And then I meet up with her that night, and she's like, well, I know you like comedy, so we're going to go to the comedy club. And we went to the Stress Factory. And Vinnie Brandt used to do... He had a phone on stage and he would prank call restaurant. He prank called a Chinese restaurant the night that we were there. And then they did a thing where there was a big movie screen in the corner.
Yeah.
And they had a camera that would point out at the crowd.
Uh-oh.
And it would put people's faces up and then it would...
Like a kiss cam.
Yes. Yeah. And it would superimpose captions.
Uh-oh.
And they put one on me, a 21-year-old me, on a date, already just such a self-conscious human being. And it just superimposed the word sex machine right below my face. And I just sat there. And I remember it went on long enough that I kind of finally gave it a like, okay, joke's over. Yes. And then that got a big laugh. Yeah. And then it stayed lingering on me. And I just had to sit there humiliated on a date. And that scared me off from comedy clubs for a while.
Yeah.
So I got lucky that UCB existed.
That's a tough date. I mean, there's only a small window where it goes well.
Yeah,
I think.
We didn't go on more dates after that.
It was
my confidence was shot. I didn't have much back then anyway. But I avoided clubs for a long time and found them very intimidating. So I was lucky that UCB kind of dovetailed into the alt.
Yeah,
it was kind of Luna Lounge into UCB, and then UCB out into Rafifi, and that's where I started doing some solo stuff.
Ah, got it. Cool. Yeah. Like when you do your one man shows. So where do you work that material out?
There's a venue in Brooklyn that I really like called Union Hall.
Oh yeah,
that's mm-hmm. a really right there. Great, great space for comedy, and
it's downstairs.
Downstairs, very intimate. They that crowd has proven to be very supportive of me.
Oh good.
Yeah, Brooklyn takes care. But then because I'm a maniac who likes to work hard, like my one man show is all about suicide attempts and stuff like that. And I would go and do that material at clubs. I would do it on the road. I'd do it at colleges because I was just like, I gotta make sure this stuff doesn't just play in Brooklyn where everybody's artsy and open to discussion. So I would just go and bomb.
Wow.
And bombing with that material.
I was going to say.
It's pretty lonely.
But that's, you know, I think, I mean, I'm out of the stand-up world, but I think some people do get into that little, you know, that kind of protective, where the audiences are great all the time. It's that cocoon. I think it's hard to step out of that, I would think, once you get used to it.
And some people can, you know, really pay their mortgage doing it and
more
power to them. But
yes.
I always wanted to be, I always really admired the people I saw who, like, I felt like Birbiglia and Mulaney were the two guys where I was like, oh, they show up at UCB.
Right.
And then they got to cut out after the show because they got to go do Caroline's.
Right.
And then they're going to go do like a weird NPR storytelling event to close up the night where I'm like, oh, you can do it all in this.
Yeah.
It's part of why I stay in New York. It's because I think as a comedian, it's still one of the only towns, maybe the only town where it's like, you can play in front of every type of crowd within 3 days.
Yes.
You can play in front of tourists, in front of Jersey, Long Island crowds. You can play in front of artsy crowds. Mm-hmm. Any you can just go find out if a joke works in front of anybody in this town.
Yeah.
That's kind of the game to me that I'm addicted to is.
And you do, it does get into a ego thing where it's like, I don't care what the conditions are. I feel that I should be able to do well.
Yeah.
No matter what. I remember I used to, there was a comic that they were putting me on after, I won't name him, at the comic strip. And he would just he had a boom box and he would just destroy.
Oh, wow.
And they'd put me on after him at like 1:45 in the morning. And I went to, it just, he was the one, I could not follow him.
And that's infuriating.
It was, and I was just like, oh, put me down for next week.
And it makes you better.
We got to set up a show with you.
Oh,
him opening for you.
I would love that.
No, I mean, that's so much of what comedy, I think that's why people stay in comedy. It is this like addictive, I don't know. You need to keep creating situations where you're able to satisfy that need to
like hunt.
It's so
for
fleeting.
Validation.
Yeah,
it's so fleeting. So,
right, because you only feel as good as your last.
That is
joke.
It's so
last
true.
Laugh.
Did you ever do a room? There's a room I'm obsessed with stories about.
Yeah,
that a lot of the New York comics used to jump out and do, called the Peppermint Lounge.
Oh, the Peppermint. No.
Do you know about this? It was largely an African American room in East Orange, New Jersey.
Where was it?
East
Orange. I never did it.
Legendarily one of the hardest rooms of all time.
Have you performed there?
No, it's closed.
Oh.
I wish.
Because
I grew up in West Orange, home of Rascals. Yeah. I never went to Rascals.
I once did. I got hired to host a fashion show in East Flatbush. And I remember, like, I saw Chris Rock, like, at the comic strip, and I, because he grew up in Brooklyn, I said, you know, I'm hosting this show in East Flatbush. He goes, I won't even go to East Flatbush. So I was like, but it was great. It was great. It was really fun.
That's still one of my favorite feelings is like, what's the scenario that's probably not going to work?
Yes.
Can I go make it work?
Yes.
And that's why I loved that when my show jumped to cable, they were like, well, you can't do it live anymore. That's insane. But then True TV, to their credit, I have some misgivings about the way I was treated there. But by and large, it was a great experience. But to their credit, they said, we want it to be live again. Mm. And being on live TV where it can be a disaster.
My God. Yeah, that's incredible.
I love it.
That they said yes to that.
Yeah, that's really cool.
So much. Loved it.
Did you ever do the Orthodox Comedy Club? They used to be in Lower Broadway on Saturday night.
Like Orthodox Jewish?
Yes. Like
Hasidic. Oh, I wish that was still around.
It was dinner, and they'd have the stand-ups go up on during dinner. And I was like, oh, they're going to they're going to hate me. But they were the hardest on Jewish comics.
Oh.
Because they were, the comics were all reformed.
Oh, right.
And so these comics.
So they'd rather a Catholic than a
They were
reformed.
Fine with me. Just because, you know, it's more of a novelty item. Whereas they, the reformed, because a lot of Jewish comics would talk about being Jewish. And they were kind of like, yeah, you're not really Jewish.
Yeah.
So, and they, I was like, oh gosh, I didn't even think of that. They'd have a tough time.
There's a guy who runs a room still, and I've never done it, and I want to. I should before I hang it up.
Yeah.
It's in a hostel on the Upper West Side.
Oh, wow.
So it's just to like German and Australian backpackers who are passing through New York.
Oh, boy.
And it's in the lobby of a hostel, and I have heard that this guy who organizes it, it's the only show he does, and he will do 15 to 20 minutes between each act.
Oh my God.
Which, if you know anything about comedy, is, that's insane. That's insane.
The Germans love it.
I love the setup of finding the worst room in America.
All I want.
Yeah.
All I want. The peppermint.
That's a show.
A comic at the Cellar, I asked him if he ever used to do the peppermint. He said, yeah. And he said he was there one night and said he saw a comic bombing, and someone in the crowd stood up and was like, get the fuck off the stage, and started, the person in the crowd had been eating buffalo wings, started just whipping the bones at him on stage.
Oh, no.
It's all I want.
What a humiliation.
It's all I want is to do a room so hard that if I fail, I'll get pelted with
chicken.
Yeah, you
come home with buffalo
just
stains.
Tell us where you're performing next, and we will bring plenty of wings.
All I want.
Oh, man.
Okay, I think...
I think we're being told.
We've been waved down.
I'm so sorry. I'm sorry.
It went by so fast.
I have some more Jersey Hell gigs I wanted to talk about.
You guys can keep in touch.
All right,
you don't have to stop talking after this recording ends.
Okay.
Chris, thank you so much. It's really fun to hear about those early New York days of yours.
I loved all of it. I just love your approach to comedy.
Oh, well, yeah.
It's really fascinating.
It's inspiring.
Yes, very inspiring.
It's a real joy to think about those days.
Mm-hmm.
To the idea that I've been like brought in any sense with your show, it's just a hugely meaningful thing to me, and I do not say that lightly. So I'm so psyched to be a peripheral part of it, and so jealous of everybody who gets to be a bigger part of it, and it's the best. It's the
well,
best.
Let us know if you'd ever like to be in a sketch when you come to LA.
Oh, that would be the dream. That would be the dream.
For God's sake,
we'll get
don't
you
be
that
jealous.
Astra insurance.
I need it. Believe me, I need some.
We'll have to do a lot of sketches on our show to get it. But
so we used to get them out. That was the best part. You're like, oh, I'll dress up as a robot again if it gets me closer to health insurance.
I need a physical. All right, thanks.
Thank you, Chris.
Thank you, guys.
Sorry, we're long.
Yeah,
I think they queued up
the sketch.
I totally forgot about it. Do you want it? Did you want us to play it?
Play it?
I will watch it. This will be the first time I've watched it.
Wait, really? Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm fascinated to see if it's as bad as I think.
Well,
Okay. If you were the writer of this, how mad you would have been at me for flubbing your bit.
I don't think I'd be mad. I think
I would
you
just be
like
relieved that I
accidents.
Hadn't fucked it up.
Yes.
That's the thing.
Exactly.
Okay, well, anyway, you know, folks, our budget's been cut so much, we're having trouble paying the rent this month. It's true. So we're doing everything we can to hide from our show's landlord. Hide from our show's landlord. There you go. Good cue.
Go on.
Apparently, we've cut back on the queuing, too. Why don't you go back and we'll try that again? I tell you, we've had to cut things back so much. We're doing everything we can to hide from our show's landlord. Huh?
Conan.
Yeah?
Hey, Conan.
I didn't expect to see you.
Well, he's on his way. Mr. Slotnick is coming.
Oh, my God. Mr. Slotnick's coming. Here we go. Come on.
Conan.
Okay, we could stop it now.
Yeah.
I have to tell the listener, Chris, it was like a 3/4 of a second delay.
Yeah.
It was such a short...
But he said it again. He said that, you hear me say, huh? If you rewind it, you hear me go, huh? When the door opens. And then he says the line again.
He saw an opportunity for a laugh.
Exactly.
That's what happened. He
you
wasn't
know what?
Mad.
I can't.
He clearly wasn't enjoying, he didn't like the Pender bit beat right before because his leg was, and he was a little self-conscious. So he was, you actually did him a giant favor.
And you know what? I would even say that the camera cut to the door was premature.
It was. Well,
I felt like that was early.
Yeah, the direct.
I'm not saying this just because you're here.
Also, I have so much more hair. I was shocked to see it.
Well,
I'm so young.
I didn't want to mention that.
I'm so young in that. It
was the
bad.
Time was like, I know that you probably felt it felt like
I could
seconds
feel also
there,
though,
but...
I could feel both. You're being so nice now, but I could feel when it happened. I could feel both of you internally going like, yeah.
No.
I was just thinking, oh, that was it? That was kind of what...
Oh, I cringe.
If your wife reaction. Knew how you spent the past hour instead of helping her with that...
Beautiful
with
baby
with Cal. Beautiful Cal.
I really do. I think you need to let this one go.
Yeah. All right. We'll wrap it up.
Okay. Okay, that was Chris.
That was Chris. He's fantastic.
Yeah, and I swear it really was like the smallest pause.
I know.
In that sketch.
I know.
We were all so angry. Underwhelmed.
We're like, that was it? Wait,
you
what?
Built this up. I was prepared to go to bat for you. And no, it was...
You were the sketch performer who cried wolf.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, I totally get it from his point of view.
I know. In your head, those, like every millisecond is interminable when you're out there and you're just feeling the weight of like the audience, like they're all holding their breath for you. And then.
But also thinking, oh, they're never going to ask me back again.
Yeah.
The trauma of that.
It would be funny if we talked to a casting director and they were like, yep, no. He screwed up.
That was it.
He's off the list.
Well, I've seen that happen.
But anyway, Chris Gethard, what a delightful guy. He
Great
has
guy.
His own podcast.
Beautiful stories from anonymous people. And it's on Earwolf.
Oh, my God.
That's crazy.
Synergy.
Unbelievable coincidence.
Weird. Yeah, it is crazy how that stuff happens. And that's our show for this week.
Yes. Thanks for listening.
Yeah, thanks.
And we'll talk to you next week.
We'll see on the flip side.
Yeah.
We like you.
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast, is hosted by Mike Sweeney and me, Jesse Gaskell.
Produced by Kevin Bartelt.
Engineered by Will Becton.
Mixed by Ryan Connor.
Supervising producer is Aaron Blaird.
Associate producer, Jen Samples. Executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross. Jeff Ross at Team Coco. And Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Earwolf.
Thanks to Jimmy Vivino for our theme music and interstitials.
You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
And of course, please subscribe and tell a friend to listen to Inside Conan on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever platform you like best.
Ta-da!
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider, and also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.